Good afternoon. I'd like to call a meeting of the House Resources Committee to order at 1:06 p.m. in room 124. Today is Friday, February 12th, 2015. Our members present are Representative Josephson, Representative Herron, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Olson, our Vice Chair, Representative Hawker, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Tallarico. Our Co-Chair Representative Nagyak is excused today. And I'd like the record to reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. I'd also like to recognize our staff. Our secretary is Julie Kohler. Thank you, Julie. And our teleconference aide is Matt Kern. Thanks, Matt. Committee aide Gary Zepp from Representative Nagyak's office is here in the room to assist anyone that needs it, as well as Julie Morris from my office. I'd like to request that you please turn off or silence your cell phones. I recognize that Representative Johnson has joined us. Today in the committee, we are still working on House Bill 247, and we are going to go through the sectional analysis. So I'd like our presenters to please introduce yourselves and your affiliation, and we'll begin.
Chairman Tallarico, members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ken Alper, the Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, this is our third presentation before you. We're not bringing in a PowerPoint. We don't have a presentation. We went through that, but at the end of our second hearing, we sort of rushed through the sectional analysis, tried to hit some of the high points. We were invited back to go through the sectional analysis and, by extension, the bill itself to a greater level of detail. If you like, I'm just going to using the document that's up on the screen, which is our paper sectional analysis that's 4 pages long, just sort of work our way, scroll our way through the bill. There's a lot of sort of technical and conforming language like all large and complex bills have. So to the extent you want to drill into the nits and nats of those, we can do that as well. Sections 1 through 5 of the bill all refer to a repealer. There are in Alaskan statutes some exploration tax credit programs that go back several decades that are dormant. They have not been used. They have not, in some cases, even been developed, the appropriate regulatory structure of the rules, but they were passed by some former legislature in some former era and are not in use. One concern or one possibility that we contemplated as many of the exploration credits in current law that are being used, what's known as the Alternative Credit for Exploration in AS 4355025, as many of those are sunsetting, we wanted to make sure that the administration's position that we don't want to be providing a separate set of benefits for exploration remains in place, so we wanted to make sure that these dormant programs didn't get resurrected, brought to life. So what you see way back in Section 40, the repealer section of the bill, is a repeal of a 4305-180I and different sections of AS 4109. So in doing so, there are other places in statute where those are referenced as part of a general reference and another concept. The specifics of Sections 1 through 5 talk about DNR and their ability to audit royalties, and it makes reference to these credits. So we are amending those sections to reflect the fact that we're repealing those sections elsewhere in the statute. It doesn't change the underlying ability of DNR to audit royalties, of course. Moving past that, Section number 6 is really a conforming change to Section number 8. Section number 8, which is a substantive piece, has to do with the limited waiver of confidentiality, the ability of the state to report on the credits that we are spending, the companies that are receiving it, and the projects.
Representative Hawker.
And apologies if I totally missed something here, but I heard you say that the substantive portion of the bill begins with Section 8?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker, the substantive portion really begins with Section 7. However, Section 6 is a conforming section that refers to Section 8. So I sort of skipped from one to the other to be able to better describe Section 6.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chairman, what Section 8 does, and I'll get to it in a minute, talks about confidentiality waivers. What Section 6 does is it talks about what is confidential. It's part of the core, we keep taxpayer information confidential, statutes that describes that activity. There's limited waiver language that says what isn't confidential. We are modifying that to include the new section that's added by Section 8 of the bill. So Section 8 is purely conforming in that sense. And we'll get to the specifics of Section 8 in a moment. If I may get back to that, I'm going to Section 7. Section 7 is the interest rate change. That is in what you call the general tax statutes, 4305. It applies not just to oil and gas, but to all taxes collected by the state. Anything coming from a delinquency, an assessment, a past due tax that we determine is owed, what's the interest rate that the state collects? That's sort of one of the core issues that the Department of Revenue deals with when it comes to collecting money. That number, just to be clear, works the same in reverse. If we find that someone's overpaid their taxes, or they pay their tax and then appeal an assessment and they win that appeal, when we pay them back with interest. We pay them at the same interest rate that we charge them for their short payments. So going a little bit through the legislative history here, for many years, the interest rate was 11%. You know, that was generally understood to be a very high rate, led to some very high compound interest calculations if years took place. Because the change that was made to this section in Senate Bill 21 created an A and a B with applicability tied to time. There is the higher interest rate of 11% was in place before January 1st, 2014. The lower interest rate, which is 3% above the federal discount rate for time after January 1st, 2014. So there are really three changes in this section. The one is we're flatly repealing the language that refers to the time before 2014 because it's obsolete. It's no longer needed. You'll see several pieces of that in the bill. We're trying to get rid of obsolete statute and shrink the statute books by a few pages. Obviously, if any issue ever comes up referring to those time periods, the statute books that were law at the time are used and nothing is compromised or lost. It's just a matter of getting less words in the law books. So that's the first and most obvious change. The second one reinstitutes the idea of compound interest. For most of history, when there was a delinquency or a tax owed, you have the basic amount that's owed, and then as interest is accrued every quarter, the interest would be added to the balance, and then new interest would be calculated on the balance plus the interest. That's the general idea of compounding. That was lost in a late amendment to Senate Bill 21. There are different opinions as to the reason for that. Most, I believe, think that that was inadvertent. It was sort of in a technical amendment that occurred in committee that was addressing a different topic. But we're reinstituting the idea of compound interest. And third, and by far the most material change in Section 7, is the change to the interest rate itself. Instead of being tied to 3% over the discount rate, we're looking to be 7% above the discount rate. The discount rate today, and it's a quarterly adjusted formula in the way the state treats it, is 1%. So we're talking about today we're collecting 4% interest. We hope to be collecting 8. You know, that number 8 is, first off, splitting the difference a little bit, going between what was too high to what is now generally considered too low. And second, and I did mention this in my initial presentation, there's some expectation during this time of shortfall that Alaska will be, to a certain extent, using earnings on our savings to help fund ongoing government operations. If that occurs, that means there's suddenly an opportunity cost to the use of our savings. If we have to pull an extra dollar out because someone didn't pay their taxes, and that person pays their taxes 3 years later, then when we repay our savings that dollar, we want to make sure that we get the amount that money would have earned had it remained in savings. So we would like to tie our interest rate approximately to the expected rate of return for the permanent fund, frankly. That's what we're working from. That number is in the 7 or so percent range according to the permanent funds consultants, Callan & Associates.
Representative Hawker and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you. You made a lot of statements there that I don't necessarily agree with, particularly that the Callan discount is the appropriate rate for the state's cost of capital, but that's a whole other story. Can you clarify for us, through the chair, when assessments are made and we're charging interest on them, does that interest commence on the date the assessment is made, or does that go back to the date that the original tax was obligated?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, the interest begins accruing on the date the tax was due.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
How many years did you say that the state was delinquent in its audit process?
Mr. Chairman, to answer Representative Hawker's question, I don't want to use the word delinquent. We do have a delay. We do have a multi-year process to audit oil and gas production tax returns. The statutes give us 6 years as a statute of limitations. We have, in prior years, pushed fairly close to that six-year deadline. By fairly close, I mean weeks or even days. We're moving off of that deadline. But the short answer is we can be up to 6 years behind. We are currently finishing calendar year 2009, which those taxes were due and payable and finalized through the true-up process on March 31st, 2010. So sometime between now and March 31st, we will be completing the rest of 2009 and issuing the appropriate assessments.
If I may follow up. I think we established at the last meeting very clearly that the motivation behind this bill was strictly to raise revenue. That was the criteria and how the decisions that were brought forward to us were established. And I can appreciate and understand that. So I have to look here and ask, did you consider any was there a consideration given to what is in fact a fair assessment rate and process, or was this simply done, literally blindly to raise revenue? And again, I'm thinking when you know you are 6 months, and I'll still use the word delinquent in your audits, you know that you can go back, and now you're asking and you're imposing a compounded rate of interest over 6 years when a taxpayer doesn't even know what their obligation is, and especially when many of these obligations, as you testified yourself, that are unresolved were because the agency, the department itself, did not have the rules and regulations and rules of the road out there for those taxpayers to even know what they could expect out of audits. And I will offer to you that I believe that had a lot to do with why the compounding factor was eliminated as the last bill went through the legislature. So I think your attribution saying that it was an error, unless you can demonstrate to me that it is in fact an error, I think it was a judgment that was made to provide a more fair tax structure. That was almost more of a statement than a question, but I can ask a question. I mean, how far wrong am I here, guys?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Hawker. The idea of going to the compounding interest at a 7% rate was simply to make whether we refunded money or collected money on an audit revenue neutral to the state. It's just totally revenue neutral. Whether we had it in advance and had it in the invested, we would get about that rate of return. So if it was owed to us, then we should have been allowed that rate of return. If we owe it back, we're not paying back any more than we would have than we had earned by having it. So the idea on this is not to raise more money. This was just simply to make it revenue neutral, with the idea that we are moving into an era where our investment returns are going to be a source of funding government services, and so we didn't want it to be more or less. We wanted it to be about the same.
If I may add one thing to clarify, Mr. Chairman, these interest rates are in no way retroactive. The interest rate that is in statute at the time covers the entirety of that time period. So the only taxpayer that might be paying this new rate for 6 years is the taxpayer that owes their taxes this year and might get audited 6 years from now. And quite frankly, we do not want that person to be waiting 6 years. We are working diligently to speed up that process and hope to be within 3 or 4 years at most of the due date. So when, for example, last year's taxes were assessed in 2015, 4.5 years of interest was in at the 11%, and the last year and change at the lower SB 21 interest rate. The lower interest rate is working its way through the system, becoming a larger and larger portion of any assessment, and then until finally it becomes the main one, or it's been changed to what changes in this legislation. And also, to be clear, there is not necessarily general fund in this. When we receive a tax assessment, that money goes to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. We don't see much, if any, general fund revenue. There is no general fund revenue impact in our fiscal note related to this specific section of the bill.
Beautiful lead-in. If I'm Mr. Chairman,
follow-up, Representative Hawker.
Beautiful lead-in. Exactly. This money, the opportunity cost for this money is not having it in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And you, Commissioner, just testified that the idea here was for the state to be revenue neutral without having that money in our accounts. Can you tell me what the current earnings on the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund are?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, they will be negative this year. Not as negative as the permanent fund, but they'll be negative. But that was done because of the situation where we're spending heavily from the Constitutional Budget Reserve to fund government. If and when we have a fiscal plan that starts using the earnings reserve of the permanent fund, then that money in the Constitutional Budget Reserve will be put back into the sub-account and will be invested in a fashion very similar to the permanent fund. So this all fits into the totality of the fiscal plan, and it makes it consistent. So.
And thank you. I think you just give there's a lot of insight you have given us there. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Upper, I think at the beginning of this discussion you talked about interest owed in the event that there was an overpayment. Can you repeat what you said about that?
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, if there is an overpayment or if there is an assessment that is paid and then protested, appealed essentially, and that goes through the process and the taxpayer wins their appeal or settles at some in-between point and we owe them a refund, we pay them the refund with the same interest rate that we receive on their overpayments, on their underpayments to us. It is a two-way interest rate, right. And that is throughout the statutes.
Just to follow up on that. So obviously, if this passes this committee and both bodies, we're taking some additional risk because we, in the event of an overpayment, would pay 7 or 8% rather than 3 or 4.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, I would say anecdotally from my own observation, from my staff's observation in the last year or so, in past years when there was an assessment, we would be more likely to get the payment and then have it appealed because companies didn't want to be on the hook for that 11% for the year or two it might take to work through the appeals process. The tendency now is more if a company is going to appeal to not pay and withhold the money until it works through the appeals process because the 3 or 4% is much less onerous to their cash flow. They're better off keeping the money in their own books until the issue is resolved.
A follow-up? Yes, it is a follow-up. Thank you. Through the chair, is it possible that 7% plus the discount rate represents a sweet spot where both parties' best auditors better bring their A games because there's, I mean, you could... There's sort of an equal liability potential for getting it wrong. Is it possible?
The chair, Representative Josephson, the oil companies are all different from each other. They have their own expectations of return on their own investment. Committees have used the term hurdle rate, which is their expected investment return, but that more or less reflects what they expect to earn on their money. Their numbers tend to be higher than that. The state's numbers tend to be lower because our money is in more conservative assets. But the intent is to tie the interest rate to the opportunity cost based on the state's investment earnings. We chose a metric in this bill that roughly approximated that. There are several different ways that could be obtained. But that's the goal, is to try to get something like the money that we would otherwise be earning if that money weren't being spent out of savings and was in the permanent fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Olson?
I've got several short questions, but they all tie together. The most completed year was 2008?
Through the chair, yes.
If you went back 10 years from there, who got favored, the state or the producers as far as the assessment?
Through the chair, I don't believe I understand the question. We're going back 10 years and who got...
Did the state collect additional monies or did the producers get money back?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, although it's by no means universal, when there is a change in an oil and gas tax return, it is almost always in the state's favor. We're looking for more money.
Secondly, out of those 10 years, how many of them went almost to the statute of limitations? You know, like 2 days, 2 weeks, a month, say within the last month where you would have lost the ability to collect additional revenue?
Through the chair, to Representative Olson's question, the statute of limitations was increased in 2007 with the passage of the ACES bill. It was one of the secondary sections of that legislation. The recognition after the passage of the earlier net profits tax, PPT, in 2006 is that the workload of auditing tax returns suddenly got much more complicated because we were dealing with upstream expenditures, a type of industry work that we had never looked at the line item detail before. So the struggle to get the PPT audit on time was seen years in advance, and we gave ourselves extra time for ACES. So that and the regulatory changes and then various statutory changes meant that we pushed fairly close to the line for 2007 and 2008. I don't believe our prior history was much like that. So in the last 2 years, we were very close to the statute.
Thirdly, you've cut back on the number of tax auditors from, what, 4 to 3, I believe?
Mr. Chairman,
that handle this issue.
Representative Olson is referring to the audit masters. Those are an exempt job classification that was added also as part of the ACES bill in 2007. The audit masters are designed to be industry-experienced people that come in at a higher rate of pay so that they can provide expertise, guidance, regulatory assistance, supervision to a certain extent. They are actually expressly prohibited from doing the auditing themselves. That was part of the language in House Bill 2001, the ACES bill of 2007. So they are helping the auditors, but they're not doing the audit. The actual audit staff has not been changed in the last couple of years.
Last question. Would it be to our advantage, everybody's advantage, to take the statute of limitations back to 3 years so the state could recapture that money more quickly than having it set out there for 6 years?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, I would say that would, if that were to happen immediately, that might cause us to do inadequate work to get to go through the next couple of years of taxes. We would be already past that statute essentially for 2010 and 2011. If there is a goal to reduce that number over the next several years, we intend to catch up to it. We're starting to do 2 years at a time. By a year from now, we will be a year off the statute of limitations. By 2 years from now, we will be 2 years off the statute of limitations. But these things can't happen instantaneously. We'd be happy to show you some of the source documents, but the upstream information provided by the major oil and gas companies is hundreds of thousands of line items. It's a massive information undertaking. There's a lot of back and forth, requests for follow-up information, examining of records. It's a very technical and complex process. I would be reluctant to say we could speed it up faster than we say we are speeding it up.
My last question for the time being, what about extending the effective date 2 years to give you 2 years to do it?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, that 2 years to catch up 3 years is probably more than we could handle. We like the idea of having a little bit of cushion. You know, what if something happens? What if you lose a key employee? What if there is another statutory change between now and then? I like having the 6 years. It is my intent for as long as I have this job to not use it. But I would strongly recommend to Representative Olson that if we want to go in that direction, let's have that conversation in a year or so about changing the statute of limitations and see how well we've followed through on our mission to catch up some.
Representative Olson.
Just a comment. Everybody in this room can be replaced. I don't believe you have one key person that would slow you down for more than several months, just like the legislature. Just a comment. Mm-hmm.
Representative Tarr,
and then Representative Park.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, some of the questions I had have been answered in these other comments, but just thinking about that, of course, you've been around for a year, so you kind of inherited where the audit work was, you know, prior to your this administration coming in. So my understanding before was how you just explained it with, you know, the PPT and the ACES changes became more complicated in terms of figuring it out, but you know, if we separated just that to get through the 2012 tax years, you know, is there a way we could sort of do that separately, you know, contract with some other company, or if is there a way that we could hire additional staff, hire someone on contract to help us get through those more quickly?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I'm not certain if more staff would speed it up. Generally speaking, each of the major producers, to limit the conversation to that, because that's where the action is, but that's certainly where the money has been. Typically has a team of three people working on it with a senior auditor and two junior auditors. They They work closely under the direction of the supervisor of the group, who's a classified staff member, and the audit master is providing technical assistance, review work, amendments to the narratives. I don't know if more bodies would speed that up. There's a lot of work to go through, but a lot of the time is in simply the back and forth and the trying to convey to the taxpayer the type of information that we need and then waiting for it to be submitted. The reason we're behind is not that it takes 6 years to do an audit, but it takes a year. But years went by in the past where we weren't finishing audits because of external factors. The initial writing of regulations after major tax changes consumes a lot of time. The implementation of the software system, the tax handling system, was a major consumer of time. What I've been saying, which I believe strongly, is that we are past all of those hurdles and all of those hiccups and all of those delay elements, and now we're simply doing our jobs. I hope that we have the opportunity to keep doing our jobs and do them well. And I hope that as we get more years behind us of a complex net profit system, that the issues where we tend to disagree with industry start working themselves out and that returns come closer to getting it right the first time.
A brief follow-up?
Representative Torr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the changes included in this legislation, in your estimation, will that simplify the process so that, you know, once we get through the ACES years and, you know, have sort of understood that, if we pass this legislation, do you think that'll simplify the process and make it a little more clear and easier to do them? I mean, can we think about that, I guess, through this process, how we might have an infrastructure that allows us to more easily do the assessments and more quickly review them so that we could get closer to what Representative Olson was saying with a shorter timeline?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, I think we're getting better at our jobs. I also think that what we're starting to see is a commingling of the two halves of the production audit group. There's one discrete group of staff that primarily deals with auditing tax returns and another group that primarily deals with auditing and reviewing requests for credits, refundable credits. Those have different timelines. They tend to be smaller dollar items. But what we've learned is the people that deal with the credit data set have become our in-house experts on upstream expenditures because that's what people are coming in with, operating loss credits or capital credits, and they are now working with the production tax people to help them develop the expertise because they need to develop that for the tax returns going forward. So there's a little bit of a streamlining. I don't know what that's going to look like in 2 years. Like all operations, it's a work in progress. And, you know, thus far, the production audit group has not absorbed any cuts. You know, I spoke to our budget subcommittee the other day. I said there are 15 fewer employees in the tax division, actual human bodies, than there were 14 months ago when the administration came in. But thus far, the production audit group has not lost any positions yet. And we're trying to keep that together because we do have a very important job for them to do. And we are close to 6 years behind, and we want to make sure that we don't miss any deadlines.
Thank you.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you, and I appreciate this, again, segue right into the question that I was looking at here, and I have always asked, as we, you know, there's the old adage that says that if it's in the yellow pages, why is the state doing it? And auditing is a real key point there. I mean, it's a very sincere question. Why do we need to keep trying to build this in-house capacity for something that is readily available at highly competent, highly qualified professional industry that is its own set of professional standards? You know, it's not like, you know, you're not going out and hiring, you know, roustabouts here to go do the tax audits. Why don't we look at reengineering government and look at outsourcing and privatizing this activity?
Let me quickly say, through the chair, Representative Hawker, and the commissioner will certainly have something to add. That's certainly outside the scope of this bill. It's an interesting conversation. I personally haven't addressed that issue in the 14 months I've been doing this job, but if you feel that would be an appropriate exercise for us to look into and do some cost estimating or theorizing about, I'd be happy to do so and come back to this or whatever the appropriate committee is at the appropriate time.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Oh, thank you. And this question you've already had, but for the enlightenment of the people that weren't in the room and the other committee, Out of 2008, the $235 million, how much was compound interest?
Through the chair, Representative Volson, the total assessments in 2008 were $265 million, of which about $115 million was interest. Only a small fraction of that was compounded, but a lot of it was interest, and $150 million was the taxes themselves. To follow up on that, I don't know if I said it to that committee. About half of that has been paid, and the books are closed, and about half of that is currently in the appeals process.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, you know, this comes down to just a policy question, but it seems like that what we're really looking at under the 4% non-compounded amount, we are asking oil companies are submitting tax forms if they would like to get a 4% non-compounded loan by maximizing all potential deductions that they could possibly achieve. And of course, if you have a long period of time, that's a great interest rate that we would all like for anything. So it is the concern that we are giving an incentive to people to absolutely maximize their deductions that they would not fraudulently, but could possibly obtain, knowing that if the if it comes back that they owe money, they've had a much lower interest rate loan than they could possibly get money for any other way. So the state of Alaska ends up subsidizing to that maximum amount.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. I mean, that possibly could be occurring, but I don't place that on industry that would be the motivating factor for why they do what they do as far as maximizing the deductions. I think they claim what they think they're eligible to claim, and then we have disputes, you know, as we go through the audits on whether some of those were actually deductible or not. So this, I'm not looking at this so much as an issue of an opportunity cost for claiming more than may be appropriate or anything like that. I just simply think that the rate that we're charging is not commensurate with the loss of revenue that the state's experienced by the taxes not being paid. And so we're not looking to make a profit with this. We're not looking to make a loss. We're just trying to make it revenue neutral. And I won't put any kind of assertion on the motivation between what people file and why.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I can't remember where you're at, Mr. Albert, but I'm sure
Chairman,
you can please continue.
We are having a general interest rate conversation as part of the discussion of Section 7 of the legislation. Moving on to Section 8, and to remind the committee, and I'll stay here all day, we have 46 sections in the bill before us. Section 8 was referenced through conforming language in Section 6. That's the confidentiality waiver specific to the state's paying of credits. And the language in the bill says the name of each person claiming a credit, the aggregate amount of credits, and the description of the taxpayer's activities that generated the credits claimed are public information. There are some limitations on that, but the key point we're putting before you is if we are spending state dollars, public money, for the purpose of subsidizing or providing a benefit to a company, that is information that we should be able to share with you, the legislature, with the general public, so that people can understand where their money is going. We have a general sunshine law type requirement to put our expenditures on the internet. The state's checkbook is available. You can find out how much we paid for chairs. You could find out how much we paid for airplane tickets. You could find out how much we paid for office supplies or consulting services. We cannot tell you how much we paid to any of these companies in oil and gas tax credits. Now, I want to be very clear here. We do know but will not and cannot report how much money companies make, how much they pay in taxes, how profitable they are. That is absolutely taxpayer confidential information. We seek no linkage or loopholes to be able to report that information. In fact, that is IRS-protected information, and if we were to attempt to do so, we would be in big trouble with the federal government, the state of Alaska would, and suddenly cease to be able to share certain information with them. They would no longer trust us. We merely want to be able to report where public money is being expended so for the purposes of providing subsidies and benefits to oil companies.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, and again, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alford, again, you previously testified that this bill was designed to raise revenue. How does this provision raise revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, that particular piece will not raise revenue, but what it does do is allow us to have a more open discussion on these issues around the revenue associated with this particular component. But it's not a revenue generating in itself.
Follow up.
And thank you. Have you done any analysis or have given any consideration to whether this provision would result in a taxpayer? And again, with all respect, Mr. Alper, a taxpayer is very different than the state of Alaska buying chairs for this committee room. That was a completely disingenuous analogy, and I frankly am a little offended by it. But we have an obligation, as you note, under the Internal Revenue Code of the federal government to protect taxpayer information, which is deemed as confidential and private. We probably found a point here where we can push that limit, we can push beyond it, and disclose particular taxpayer information. Do you have any idea, any analysis, whether disclosing this information compromises the competitiveness, the competitive advantage, the, if you want to call it, the business model, all of those elements that go into an entity's ability to be competitive? Or are we going to be asking one company, because they're taking this, to disclose information that could very well be place them at a significant competitive disadvantage in the marketplace? Have you done an analysis that you can give me an assurance that we are not going to compromise the individual competitiveness of our taxpayers?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker, we have spoken to our own counsel at the Department of Law about the degree to which this provision might expose us to being forced to or able to disclose the other information I described earlier, that the tax, the earnings specific, the tax paying specific, and we're assured that there was no potential linkage there. The activities described in Section 8 of the bill are somewhat aggregated in nature. You know, Company X received $10 million last year for drilling a well in the X unit. That doesn't, I'm not providing information about their vendors, about their cost of capital, about their labor practices. It's very high level information, summary level information that I have a hard time envisioning rising to the level of being an imposition on someone's competitiveness with their fellow players in the oil field.
Mm-hmm. Follow up.
And thank you. And you said that you're envisioning this. Are you an expert in knowing whether or not I disclosing the fact, and use your own example, XYZ company, which owns leases all across the North Slope, has specifically invested in this particular project, in this particular part of the basin, that may very well disclose their own prospectivity information, their own, name it, whatever, the stratigraphic information that would be literally being pointing to everybody else in the world to look at that and say, hey, look at that. They're making a real play over here. We got a lease sale coming. Let's go bid higher on a lease sale to take land away from them that they may have developed information on. I mean, I can run just as many speculative opposite scenarios to say we're asking to compromise the competitive advantage that a company gets by investing its money, and that we, the legislature, have said we will, in fact, provide you a incentive credit to do some of this activity. It's obviously a philosophy point here, but I just... I want to respect the taxpayers. I want to give them the advantage that when they make an investment in the state of Alaska, they are given the greatest advantage possible for having made that investment.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hawker is right. There is a philosophical issue, and people can disagree, and I don't want to continue debating the specifics of this idea. I will say that it is known where people are drilling. People get drilling permits, all that, and that's available. Plans of development are on the internet. Many of the existing credits that DNR authorizes, the exploration credits, come with them. The requirement for seismic stratigraphic downhole data. It is not unusual for a certain amount of that information to be made public. All we're looking to talk about here is dollars. You know, compared to some of this other information, the mere fact that someone is drilling a well in this part of the state is already known. All that this additional increment of information is going to let people know is how much, approximately how much they spent, if you could reverse engineer that from how much of a state credit benefit they got.
Representative Herron and then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the administration, two questions. Is why at this time you've decided to do it? I mean, we've heard of the mechanics of it, but why has the administration decided to insert this in a bill? And the second part of the question is, has this previous administrations, has this ever been attempted before the legislature in the past?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I think the issue of more transparency came up when we tried to actually have any kind of discussions on credits and found that we simply couldn't provide the information that people were asking, a lot of people from this particular body, that when we wanted to discuss this issue of credits and whether we thought there needed to be some adjustments made. And people were greatly frustrated by the fact that we could not give them granular enough information for them to even remotely make a decision. And so part of that was driven just by the fact that in order to have open, transparent decisions, some of this information, which we feel, quite frankly, is not confidential, should be available for that. The second part of the question, I don't know whether it's been attempted before or not. I don't know if you do, Ken.
Chair, Representative Herron, I don't believe so, no. Tax credits as an idea, as a concept, have become an increasingly, I won't say controversial, but high-profile issue with the general public. There's a lot of commentary, a lot of thoughts. You read the op-eds and blog comments and the like. I think those conversations would be better informed if people had more complete information and more understanding of what we actually were talking about regarding what sorts of activities the state of Alaska is benefiting, is subsidizing with these programs.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Yes, just to, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alper, just to follow up on your comment about the publicly available information about drilling and permits and plans of development. I take your point I've attended last fall during Resources Development Conference. There was a major lease sale going on down the hall at Denina Center. Most of these companies are eager to report their successes, and I assume they do that for a show of you know, confidence in the shareholder or the Alaska people. And so I think I take your point on this. Thank you.
If I may, through the chair, Representative Josephson, Representative Hawker is right. Companies don't like to share their results. If they've drilled a well, we're going to be able to say they spent $20 million or whatever the cost was on that well. We're not going to tell anyone that they found oil, and that's where the competitive advantage as to who's going to go and try to lease the lot next to them is going to come from.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess part of the problem that's come up was that there were, for instance, in Cook Inlet, we had a number of players, some that went bankrupt, but the state of Alaska was expending a tremendous amount of money. But we couldn't find out how much. You know, publicly available, it was said, oh, yeah, we're using the tax credits that were offered to finance, and we got $50 million of financing because, you know, so companies would say this, but we couldn't find out how much we were investing in a particular company because that was confidential information coming from our own sources. And so you could look in the newspaper, but I think that it's really imperative on us to be able to tell our people what we are investing in. And if we are investing an amount of money in certain companies, certain areas, that should be something that we should be able to tell our constituents. And And is there anything in this section of the bill that does anything other than that gives the state the ability to say how much tax credits they gave a particular company?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the section is somewhat broad, although it primarily will be enable the state to report refundable tax credits, which are truly an expenditure of the state, and I would posit is not the same as saying a change to tax. There are circumstances where credits used against tax liability would fall under this definition. Looking at the specific exclusion of 024J on line 27 of page 4 of the bill, if any members have the bill in front of them, that is a reference to the per taxable barrel credit, the sliding scale barrel credit on the North Slope. You know, and some of the thought there was, if we're going to report the amount of per barrel credits a company got, and we already know how much production they have, because that's public information, someone could reverse engineer their sales price. So that was something we wanted to be able to protect. But other credits against liability, for example, the $5 a barrel credit from New Oil or the small producer credit, those would be similarly reported the way the section is written right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. just to follow up on Mr. Alper's comment about, you know, the interest from the public, I was remembering and just looked that there was legislation in 2013. Senator Gardner had a bill about disclosing this information, and I remember receiving interest from my neighbors that they felt like, just as Representative Seaton was just saying, that this is information that, you know, the public wants to have some knowledge of so they can understand how we're making decisions. And one of the things we've been talking a lot about is just trying to understand better, you know, if the credits are having the intended effect on development, exploration and development activities. And I see this provision as perhaps helping us getting closer to answering those questions, too. And I just wondered if you could comment on how that might help us better understand if we're, you know, doing the right thing, because if we're not getting the, you know, that was one of the criticisms of ACES, for example, was, you know, that the credits weren't linked to production. So now we've got credits that are more closely, or the per barrel credit that's, you know, linked to the actual production. We've been for a while now having that conversation of, you know, how do we better understand if the tool we used is getting the result that we want? And it just seems to me this might be one way to get a little more of that information.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, in response to previous testimony, and the commissioner and I have been talking to our staff back at the Department of Revenue, and we are going to come back to this committee with a much more detailed and granular explanation modeling as to some of the impacts of this bill and how they might impact a theoretical or particular project. If we were able to talk with more precision about actual things that had occurred or were going to occur, it would be, frankly, much easier to tell this story. But that's a story we're not able to tell under the law the way it's currently written.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you again. You know, I've appreciated that word about reverse engineering, because that's really what this analysis of this information would do, that would potentially compromise the proprietary trade information of any given company. You said all those credits in 4355, with the exception of the per barrel, we're loosely using that word credit on that one, as we have agreed before, but you can take a cost-based credit. We disclose it. Someone can reverse and go back to extrapolating the amount of expenditure that was required to generate that credit. And, you know, levels of expenditure levels, investment levels, are pretty proprietary information when you have to look at them in terms of individual prospects that would arguably be being disclosed here. So, again, that's the thing to keep in mind. When we demand this information, and sure, and as we want to sit here and make laws, it would be nice to have all that individual taxpayer information. We have to accept that some things we just can't have out of respect for both federal law and that competitive advantage. But where we can reverse engineer these cost credits, we're truly going to be exposing companies to actually have to divulge a great deal of their proprietary information, cost efficiency, their capital allocations, various other economic models. As I turn to the question, in that these are all credits under 4355, would that include also the net operating loss credit carry forward?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker. The representative made a longer statement that then asked us a relatively targeted question at the end, so I'll limit my response to the question at the end. Yes, as written, this section would require that we would divulge the size of an operating loss credit.
And so, excuse me, Mr. Chair, but there we have just divulged a taxpayer's most critical information. That's their taxable level. That is exactly what the federal government does not want us to be doing to an individual taxpayer. And again, I certainly disagree with the Attorney General of the Department of Law if they say this is okay.
Through the chair to Representative Hawker and the broader concept, there is certainly there's a dissonance in priority between what we see to be the state's need to, or the state's benefit to divulge certain information, and industry's need to keep something secretive. We hope to, we'd like to find language that's acceptable to all parties as this bill moves forward. You know, Representative Hawker made an excellent point. In some ways, if we were to limit this type of disclosure to just cash credits where they're receiving an appropriation of state funds, that might be something a little narrower and a little bit more, a little bit less challengeable as proprietary accounting information. The operating loss credit is an interesting point to raise because it relates back to a company's profits and losses. You understand our intent in proposing this section. It is a very complex area of law, and we look forward to working with you to try to find language acceptable to everybody.
Thank you.
May I continue? Oh.
Yep. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just thinking, though, and I guess it would just depend on the size of the company. I'm kind of thinking out loud here because in terms of looking at operating loss, because, say, for the big three, some of them don't do separate accounting and separate Alaska operations from worldwide operations. So we would just get the aggregate information relative to the whole company. And it would be just the portion of credits that were Alaska development?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, that's not quite right. The type of accounting by aggregation and apportionment is relative to our corporate income tax structure. Mm-hmm. The oil and gas production tax is quite discrete in its Alaska-specific revenues and expenditures, and there's a lot of restrictive language in existing law that says what isn't an allowable deduction. Obviously, they're spending the money, but they don't get to count it. A classic example is, say, lobbying expenditures. The legislature, at that moment where the switched to a net profits tax, chose to specifically exclude lobbying expenses. So although the companies spend the money, and the presence in this room would prove that, those dollars are not deductible from production tax.
Thank you.
So if I may, Mr. Chairman, Sections 9, 10, and 11, we're back to conforming language. These are three of the credits that were built into the corporate income tax statutes, added by different pieces of law in three different time periods. The Section 9 refers to the gas storage facility, or the SINGSA credit. It was part of the Cooking Recovery Act. It provided a credit to build the Kenai gas storage facility after it passed in 2010. Section 10 refers to the LNG storage facility credit, written primarily around the interior gas utility in Fairbanks, but also available to other bulk storage tanks for LNG that might be built elsewhere in the state. And finally, Section 11 is the in-state refinery tax credit. That was passed, the most recent credit added in 2014. We're not changing those credits in any way, but those credits all contain language that says before a company is eligible to receive the money, that we have to make sure that they don't owe any taxes to the state. That's what current law says. If they owe production tax, property tax, cigarette tax, it doesn't matter. If they owe any taxes to the state, that could be withheld before they get paid their credits. What we are changing in these sections is broadening that to say outstanding liability to the state, period, and deleting the sentence that says for unpaid delinquent taxes. So now suddenly if the company in question might owe money to the state not part of the tax code, the most obvious example would be a royalty or a lease payment to the Department of Natural Resources. That also could be offset against a credit payment before we paid it. So So the structure of 7, of 9, 10, and 11 is identical. We're simply broadening that ability to withhold funds for other obligations to the state.
Representative Josephson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Alper, the Alaska Oil and Gas Association expressed some concern that this section is sort of an overreach, that there could be some de minimis fee or tax that's owed, and it would hold up the process of receipt of the credit. Is there any merit in your mind to that, or is that more alarmist than you would view it?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I don't want to use the word alarmist. If the issue itself is de minimis, then the withhold would be de minimis. If someone's fighting over a $500 fine somewhere, we're only going to hold back $500 from the credit. It's not that the entire credit gets stopped in its tracks over the dispute. It's that the amount of the dispute is held essentially in escrow until. And just to be clear, this is a specific issue that we have faced within in the last year, where someone is seeking a credit, but there's other state agencies saying, "Hold on a second, they owe us money."
Mm-hmm. Representative Hawker,
thank you again, and I understand and appreciate the intent you're making here, and that's to protect the state against someone who, quite frankly, is going to take advantage of the tax structure to get funds back from the state when, in fact, they really ought to be paying us for something. I totally get it. But I truly believe this is horribly inartful language. And I'll be honest, I heard a reference to the AOGA work. I'm not privy to that. I haven't seen it. I haven't looked at it. But I'm speaking only on my own behalf here. The way I would read this as a guy who actually once upon a time was a CPA and once upon a time did tax returns, any claimant, I mean, basically, if they have a liability is the word you use here, liability to the state, you can basically withhold anything. You know, a taxpayer accrues a liability to the state every single day of their operations. And whether that liability be an accrued for property taxes, it be an accrual for payroll taxes. These companies have millions of dollars of payroll in the state. They have a liability to the state every time they write a payroll check.
11.
And the whole point of this language that you're deleting here is that, yeah, we wanted to be able to withhold payments to companies who have an unpaid delinquent tax. And that was there so that we didn't cross that line of the universal definition of liability. I think payroll is probably my best example. You write one paycheck, you have a liability to the state to transmit those funds that you have withheld from that payroll check. That could very well be used here to completely eliminate, shut down entirely, a refundable tax credit program. Now, I respect and I appreciate the desire to tighten this up. This is horribly and artfully done, and I really ask you to go back to the drawing board and try to find a way to not cast such a broad net.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate Representative Hawker's question, and I've previously spoken to the intent, which is that only the amount of any liability would potentially be withheld from our credit. But I want to make clear that, and we'll get to it later in this document, we have added a definition of outstanding liability to the state in Section 39 of the bill, because we've now created a new concept that used to say an outstanding liability of the state for delinquent taxes. We've created a new concept called outstanding liability to the state, and it means that I'm reading from Section 39 of the bill, an amount of tax, interest, penalty, fee, rental, royalty, or other charge for which the state has issued a demand for payment that has not been paid when due, and if contested, has not been finally resolved against the state. So I'm happy to work with the committee to further refine that, but I believe we have resolved a lot of the potential issues that Representative Hawker raised in this comment.
And I would argue that, just again, real fast, a very, very quick read here is that the way you have written this would say, you know, you've assessed me a fee. I'm having a legitimate, I as a taxpayer am pursuing a legitimate remedy to challenge your assessment to me, and you're going to shut me down completely with receiving any funds from the state while I am in very good faith contesting an assessment, and it could be literally any, and again, it could be a payroll tax assessment, it could be anything. So again, yes, we need to keep working on not casting this net too wide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
On that point, does that net, is that for non-tax liabilities as well?
The Chair, Representative Herron, yes. We have current ability to withhold taxes for any tax liability. The intent is to broaden that for other liabilities to the state, with, once again, the most prominent ones being royalties, lease payments, AOGCC fines, those kind of things that are relevant to the oil and gas industry. And once again, per Section 39, there has to have been an assessment, a demand for payment, and then a non-payment on that demand for it to trigger the condition here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to have I was out of the room. I just wanted that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Section 12 of the bill is very much a material section. 4355.011F is the so-called floor provision of current law. It's the minimum tax for production from the North Slope. And as currently written, it is a step-down tax. Most people think of it colloquially as a 4% floor, but in fact, that's only true if the price of oil for the last year has averaged greater than $25. Thankfully, for modern history, that has been our reality. But should the price of oil drop between 20 and 25, it goes to 3%, and 1750 to 20, if I have it right, it goes to 2% and steps down from there. Hopefully, we never are experiencing that or having to worry about that. In any case, all of that is repealed and reenacted. I'm always uncomfortable with the repeal and reenact, but because of all that step-down language, it was simply for drafting simplicity easier. We are replacing all of that with a 5% floor, 5% minimum tax. And that's 5% of the gross value at the point of production. As you know, the underlying tax is a net profits tax, or it's a tax on of a calculation called production tax value, which is an analog for net profits. When that number is, when adjusted for certain credits, is less than a number that equals 4% of gross revenue, then the larger gross revenue figure is paid, an alternative minimum tax. The Section 12 of the bill increases that by 25% from 4% to 5%.
Representative Hawker.
And Mr. Chairman, again, I ask, as you have promised, as we discussed earlier, you are going to provide the committee with some analysis, some granular analysis of the consequence of the provisions in your bill. This is one of those that's, it's really significant. As you testified last time we were here, this provision effectively increases taxes on companies that are already today losing money in the state of Alaska. And so I really would like to know truly what the consequence is going to be on industry on a financial perspective, as well as this is one where you're going to give us some macroeconomic. What is this really going to do to the state's competitiveness and our ability to continue to attract investment capital? Again, see, this is not just a simple credit change. It's not a simple repeal and reenact. This is a very, very material provision. And I'm really looking for some very explicit analysis of what the consequences of this provision will be on our international competitiveness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't believe that there's a response to that question. We absolutely intend to go into that level of detail with the quantitative presentation we'll be preparing for the next time you hear us on the bill, whenever that might be. Moving onward to Section 13.
Representative Josephson, thank you. Is this the provision through the chair that might generate $50 million in additional revenue to the state?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, should the price of oil in a given fiscal year, in the fiscal note, be below the amount that to where we're out of the minimum tax range and into the underlying production tax, yes. And for the foreseeable future, per the Department of Revenue's forecast, we're seeing the price of oil to stay below that approximately $85 a barrel price. That's the threshold for the minimum tax. So about $50 million a year of revenue is tied to the change in Section 12.
Just to follow up on that, relative to Representative Hawker's question, and I certainly respect the importance of the question, at some fundamental level, isn't the question, what does the loss of $50 million in profit at a certain barrel price due to our competitiveness vis-a-vis other worldwide markets. Isn't it sort of that simple at some basic level? And as sort of a second part of that is, how could we possibly analyze such a thing if you know?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson. The Oil and Gas Competitiveness Review Board, in their report that they put out last year, actually did look at some of the tax rates in other, what they felt to be competitive areas. That, you know, they didn't go to Saudi Arabia to see that, but they looked at, you know, Kansas and Wyoming and Texas and Canada and the places that would directly compete in the market for that, and they did look at what some of the tax rates were in those regimes, and we'll bring that information forward.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the Competitive Review Board, when was the last time they met?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, it's been more than 6 months. Because of the downturn in the market, several of the people just simply said we need to focus on our business, and they've resigned from the board, and it hasn't been put back together. So
has the governor put people reappointing people to that?
The last conversation I had with the governor's office was that they had some people that they were considering, and they were looking for more names as well. So it's been they've struggled with getting the board back up and running. And the next report from that board really isn't due till January of 2017, but the board had taken on a more aggressive agenda than what was dictated in the statutes. And one of the reports that they were trying to achieve this year was a competitiveness review. But one of the primary people involved in that is one of the people that resigned.
Right. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I would think that now would be the time to redouble your efforts in getting those people appointed so that those kind of reviews could be done, either that or take it on as a project for the department, because I think that's part of what we're talking about here is how competitive we are on a worldwide and a nationwide basis. I think the fact that it's missing and we haven't appointed people, I'd like to see them. I don't know if we even confirm them, but I think we do. I'd like to certainly see them in our next round of confirmations if we have them.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I don't think those are confirmed positions, but we are working diligently to try and get them filled.
Mm-hmm. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Everybody in the room can do the math, but could you please put on the record how much of an increase percentage-wise this is? And then the policy question is so our oil and gas companies are in a negative cash flow position right now. Why would we want to tax them?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, the first half of your question is easier to answer, of course. If the tax rate's 4% and we're increasing it to 5%, that's 25% higher. That's the increase. As to why, well, we have a tax system that includes an alternative minimum tax for a reason. It's to protect the state from the potential consequences of the switch to a net profits tax. There was no minimum tax during the era of ELF, say. Well, there was measured in cents per barrel, but the idea was we're getting a percentage of gross, regardless of what the company's expenses were, regardless of whether they were making money. We weren't calculating profitability, so we weren't taxing profitability. You know, in an era where we're allowing the offset for operating and capital expenditures, we get to a circumstance where the company might be losing money, but that means that our taxes could go below zero, a risk that we didn't have during the ELF era. So this minimum tax is there to protect the state in case of that eventuality. Once we've accepted that as a premise, then it's just a matter of what's the appropriate level, and we're positing that the appropriate level is slightly higher than we currently have in statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Representative Herron also. And this actually goes back to the discussion that Representative Hawker brought up earlier. And part of the reason that there's an increase in all these various industries across the state was the governor simply said he wanted everybody to participate in the fiscal situation that the state was facing. So there wasn't anything magic about the 5%, except that it was simply a component of the oil and gas industry contributing as well. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's important that we actually have this on the record, their explanations. Thank you.
Representative Hawker.
I think there was also a previous question there about what is the effective tax rate as a result of this change. I don't think we've quite gotten to that point. But it's repeating back what we've talked about. And you just offered it again. This was to raise revenue without consideration of the consequences on the state's competitive ability to attract capital, to keep reinvestment going, and continue to develop our, with all respect, which is a field in its later stages, particularly Prudhoe and its and the North Slope, in a very well-developed, aging field with aging resources and much more difficult, more expensive to extract. We raise this rate without any real understanding of what the consequences are. We lose our competitiveness. We saw what happened under ACES when we raised taxes too far. Again, it's so important for us to know what the total government take under this additional scenario becomes. So we've got some basis for evaluating our continuing competitiveness, because I mean, you start to ask the question, it's great to grab a whole bunch of money from these guys right now, but where are we going to get our money in 5 years when production collapses again? And again, these are the kind of questions we need to see answered.
So, Mr. Chairman, moving on, if that's all right, to Section 13. Section 13 is one of those very long sections because of the standards of statutory construction. That they will redraft the entirety of a subsection, in this case 4355020A, regardless of the smallness or tightness of the actual amendment. So the Section 13 is 8 pages of the bill, but it only actually makes 2 changes. What 4355020 does is it describes the process, the quite laborious process, by which producers make a monthly installment payment on their production taxes to the state. And it's so long because there's separate provisions and rules for different time periods and also different segments, the North Slope, oil from Cook Inlet, gas from Cook Inlet, oil produced after 2022 when the gross tax on gas kicks in, and all of these different scenarios and alternatives each has its own very complex language in 4355020. And we're not changing the idea of a monthly tax installment payment, but that language does reference in a couple of places the minimum tax. And it says, given XYZ set of circumstances, they pay 4% of the gross, and we're going in and saying, well, now they're going to pay 5% of the gross. So there's 2 specific reference points where we're changing another number to 5, and that's so Section 13 is conforming to the change made to the minimum tax rate in Section 12.
Representative Hawker.
And thank you again. Point well made. Long section, small change, but could be really, it'd be possible to make this a very, de minimis, non-effective change. I've got a larger question for you. And I'd note, it's a great place to look, page 6, line 9, which is the prefacing point of this whole section. And this whole section in statute is basically the statute, it's part of the statement of taxes. It's how the instructions for making the payment to the state of a tax liability. And, section, page sentence 9, for a calendar year, which defines that our tax period is a calendar year. This is a way to try to make a provision for periodic deposits of tax throughout the year, and then, of course, it's got to true up at the end of the year. You've testified, you've told me personally, that you guys had some serious problems with a true up at the end of a year because the section did not capture all of, on a ratable basis, as we have prescribed here, all the taxes that were due by the end of the year in full compliance with statute. I'm just wondering, while you're only making this small change in this section for the proposed change in the minimum tax floor, Is this a section you really ought to look at, you might want to look at to find a way to do a better job of ratably collecting the taxes that are owed, as you have stated yourself that that is a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, and I'm sure the committee and you yourself will have specific questions on the change that's in Section 17 that you referred to, having to do with the true-up and how certain credits are treated. That is an issue we found to a specific circumstance related to the treatment of per taxable barrel credits, and we'll get to that at the appropriate time. I personally would like to see a simplification of this section. I find it, frankly, almost unreadable. And here I am responsible for implementing it. I know what it does. I know what it purports to do. I have seen it evolve over the years as various pieces of oil and gas legislation have worked through the body. I have seen, because of the nature of it, that it refers to a lot of things that aren't being amended, but it puts them in black and white. It draws attention to issues that people are unaware of. If it could be simplified, that would be great. But the fact that we have different tax regimes and different tax treatments for multiple areas throughout the state is what makes it necessary to have such a complicated structure to make monthly estimated tax payments. At some point, it might behoove the state to come to a statewide, more uniform structure for oil and gas taxation, and then we could simplify this section. So if I could move ahead to Section 14, which begins several pages later. So within Section 13, and I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of what we refer to as applicability language inside the oil and gas statutes that say this subsection refers to production before 2014, this refers to production between, before 2016, before 2011. So within 4355.020, 020 sub 1 and sub 2 both refer exclusively to production that takes place prior to January 1st, 2014. They're remnant sections from before the effective date of Senate Bill 21. So later on in this legislation, we're looking to repeal 0201 and 2, which will, frankly, reduce the footprint of that section and make future amendments, if necessary, take less pages in the bill. But in making those repeals, we need certain conforming language elsewhere in law. So if you look at, I don't like repealed and reenacted because it tends to bring up people's suspicions and think that something's being hidden in there, but I can assure you that all that Section 4 is doing is repointing existing law that talks about a technical part of monthly installment payments and eliminates the reference to A sub 1 and A sub 2 because those are being repealed elsewhere in the bill. And you could see on the second line of the bill itself, line 22 of page 13, where it says A sub 3, 5, 6, or 7, there's references in current law that also talk about A sub 1 and 2.
Quick question.
Representative Hawker.
I don't know the answer to. Do we need to keep these sections in statute while we have yet unresolved the audits for this period? Again, if we take them, I don't know the answer to that question.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, no, we do not, absolutely. It is quite clear the history, the case law. If there is a dispute on a tax that took place in year X, the statutes that were in place at the time are what govern that dispute. So Section 15 and 16 are the same as Section 14, only they're amended rather than repealed and reenacted. They remove references to A sub 1 and A sub 2 in other technical sections relating to monthly installment payments. So if you look at, say, line 3 of page 14 of the bill, where it references A sub 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, or 7, and it's being replaced with just A sub 3, 5, 6, and 7, because 1 and 2 are being eliminated, the same exact structure in line 23 of page 14, eliminating the references to A sub 1 and 2. Again, A sub 1 and 2 are repealed in the repealer section of the bill, currently section 40. And they refer only to production and monthly installment payments prior to January 1st, 2014. Moving ahead to section 17, this is one of the most material sections of the bill. This is a new section of law. There is no 4355.022 currently. and it's titled quite clearly Limitations on Tax Credits. It's a limit in the applicability of certain tax credits to either reduce taxes or be claimed. So 022B, the first part just lays the framework. The second and third parts make actual changes. What B says is that you can't, if you have these credits, you can't use them to reduce your monthly installment payment below the minimum tax level. And there's very complicated reference points, and I hate seeing that. 0208, sub A, sub 5, sub B, sub 2, and sub A, sub 7, sub A, sub 2, those look like serial numbers or maybe droids. But those are actually references to statute that specifically identify the 5% minimum tax, or in current law, the flexible 4 through 0% minimum tax. And what it says is, if you are in possession of a certain credit, you cannot use it to reduce your monthly installment payment below the minimum tax level. So it's going to require a higher monthly installment payment. Continuing on to subsection C, that says that the use of those credits may not, over the course of a year, may not exceed the sum total of the amount you were used in the 12 months of the year. So that reflects the specific circumstance where, and it almost entirely refers to the per taxable barrel credit, although it is written more broadly. In a year where there's very high volatility, and I'm going to use calendar year 14 as the perfect example because this was an issue that arose during calendar year 14, there were months earlier in the year where the price of oil was quite high. The per taxable barrel was a number less than 8. It was $5 or $6 a barrel. The companies were able to claim it, reduce their taxes, and pay at some higher level. In the later months of the year, as the price started to drop, we reached the bottom of the per taxable barrel credit, the $8, the maximum figure, and then as prices dropped yet further, you saw the limitation on the use of the per taxable barrel credit because you can't use them in current law to go below the minimum tax payment. The floor stands in the way of the use of minimum tax of the per barrel credit. At the end of calendar year 14, we had 12 monthly installment payments, and we thought we had our revenue for the year. As it turned out, when we commingled the 12 months and did the true-ups, the Department of Revenue owed refunds of somewhere between $100 and $150 million to the suite of producers because of the ability to, in effect, migrate some of those per-barrel credits from month to month. That's a very complicated technical concept. It's very hard to explain with words. I will be bringing in slides and examples and formulas to show how that has worked in practice and how we're intending to correct it with the change in Section 17C.
Guess what?
Representative Hocker.
I have a question. And I'd like to point to the exact language. This really isn't as difficult as you would propose it to be. It's really quite simple. Is you state in your sectional analysis, this, meaning this Section 17, effectively turns the per barrel taxable credit into a monthly rather than an annual calculation. I mean, that's basically what it's doing. You are significantly changing the entire premise upon which our whole tax structure is designed, and that is that it is an annualized calculation rather than a monthly calculation. This is a, frankly, you're right, it's huge. It is an absolute, complete, and total change because you're now basically requiring, you know, forget the fact, it's no longer an annual calculation. It's purely monthly. And I would suggest that it's very, you'd be not unlike telling an individual, you know, somebody that's got income that fluctuates throughout the year, personal income, that you pay your taxes on the 1 month that you got income at a very high personal tax rate, rather than on the rate that applies on an average throughout the year under the Internal Revenue Code. Just because you had that spike, it's like, my God, he made all his money in 1 month of the year, we're going to tax him at the maximum, all that money at the maximum rate, rather than a tax structure that, again, I'm repeating, but allows it to be annualized with an annualized rate. Very much going to be looking forward to the consequences that you show for this. And again, we really have to have the concept of fairness introduced into this dialogue. I mean, what is fair? What is reasonable? And frankly, if you want to nail folks just on their hiring, just, you know, let's just be honest about what we're doing here. This is just purely a money grab.
through the chair, Representative Hawker, the several things I want to address here. First off, there is zero impact in our fiscal note from this provision simply because we don't project volatility, and the issue before us is only relevant when there is volatility, change in price from month to month. The material impact on the state happened in the past. This was a $100 to $150 million impact on the state in the true-up of the calendar year 2014 taxes. I do want to be quite clear that the per taxable barrel credit in current law is already a monthly calculation. It is based on the price of oil in that month, whether the per barrel credit is $8, $7, all the way down to $0. So it is already reflecting fluctuations from month to month in the gross value of the oil. What we're attempting to constrain is the ability to take that $1 or $7 or $8 and move its value, its implication from month to month within a tax year. And it is an issue of policy. It's an issue where individuals are going to disagree, and it's something that we see to be a priority to protect the state's interests in the event of volatility.
Representative Hawker, follow up.
Again, so if you're saying obviously the state can't predict this because of the volatileness of it, I can't see that a taxpayer could predict it either and have any assurance other than just knowing that when, you know, we are going to take away all the upside of any individual month's price fluctuation, the state's going to take that from you, so that all we're leaving our taxpayers with is the bottoms of the fluctuations, and we are by statute taking away all of the upside. It's a policy call, but it's one that I'm personally particularly troubled by here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by no means are we taking all of the upside. We may be taking a little bit more of it, and I would even go further and say during the ACES era, when the entire tax rate with progressivity was varied from month to month, we took a substantially larger portion of the upside from industry than we do currently. This bill takes a tiny fraction of that back, and only in circumstances where there's quite low prices in certain months of the year.
Okay, one more follow-up there.
Follow-up.
You said that this element was not in your fiscal note. Does that mean that you actually do have a much more granular analysis than is in your fiscal note? Your fiscal note basically just says, you know, one lump number, this is what we want to put aside into a tax credit fund for the future with no analysis. So do you have an analysis that you can give us on the components, the financial consequences as you estimate them on the various components of this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, we could we have an analysis of how it works in practice in a theoretical year with high volatility. I would love to be able to bring the specifics of calendar year 14 before the committee. Because we have at least three taxpayers and aggregated data, I want to check with my staff and my counsel to see if we could show it. It's actually a very interesting calculation. I found it fascinating when I saw it myself, and it led to a conversation, internal discussion among our staff as to whether we wanted to go forward with this provision, and the consensus was that it would be a good idea, that it would be in the interest of the state. And I do want to bring it before the committee at a level of granular detail. The reason it's not in our fiscal note is because our fiscal note is tied to our revenue forecast. Our revenue forecast is, by its nature, lumpy. It has an average price of oil for each fiscal year, but it doesn't contemplate the possibility of volatility within an individual fiscal year.
Representative Herron.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you, in your opening statement, you said that page 15, line 19, this section's a brand new section. There isn't one like it in the statutes. And so my smart staff, they Googled this title, Limitations on Tax Credits. And interestingly, what came up is it's a tax increase. So, Ken, if it looks like a tax, walks like a tax, why don't we just call it a tax increase?
Through the chair, Representative Herron, it is a tax increase. I don't think we're attempting to disguise that. This bill is doing two things. It is the majority of the changes made by House Bill 247 reduced the use of credits and the state's outlay in spending money on credits or defer or make various changes related to credits. A few of the changes increased the state's revenue in certain specific circumstances, primarily dealing with the minimum tax. Section 17 is one of those categories. It would, you know, what it would do if it were triggered, if a condition were met, would increase the amount of money that the state got from a given oil and gas producer. That is a tax increase. It shows up on the revenue, not the expenditure side of the ledger, without question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems that there is a problem with the volatility, even though it's a monthly per barrel credit, and that's because the per barrel credit can be different from month to month. So if we went back to the $5 per barrel tax credit throughout without any sliding scale, would that take care of this volatility problem?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I'm not certain. I believe it would to a large extent, but not completely. With volatility, and for example, a $5 flat per barrel credit, as in the version, say, of Senate Bill 21 that was passed by the Senate before it came to this committee in 2013, if you have months with very low prices where the $5 was limited by the floor, there might be the ability to shift some of that around. We haven't specifically modeled it, but we will find that out as part of our analysis when we come back.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I just like that the language here, I don't want to get too wrapped around the axle here, but if we could expand that and clean that up just a little bit, I'm not saying the language is so clever that I think people are being tricked, but it certainly tricks me a little bit. Because I have a question about the way we've structured the calendar year versus the monthly estimate versus what you can do in the end in the credits. And it looks like to me that you can't do anything forward, although we may have promised a credit, we may have a particular credit in 1 month. Could you assure me that do these credits move forward at all, and do they compile for the end of the calendar year when these folks figure this out, or is this strictly limits us just to the monthly configuration?
Let me try, Mr. Chairman. The tax is an annual tax, full stop. Okay. The credits are annual credits. What Section 13 does is describe mechanisms for monthly estimates that are supposed to add up to an annual tax. We are attempting through these sections in this portion of the bill to harden up some of those monthly calculations to make it more closely so that the sum total of the 12 monthly calculations more closely adds up to the annual total. But in the end, the value of the credit as earned for the year, unless there's the specific limitation we're trying to fix in Section 17, where if it's limited because of the minimum tax in a month, that month's limitation should carry through for the rest of the year. What we're trying to prevent is if there's a limitation in 1 month, that the company can't scoop up that limited credit by applying it against another month's taxes. So I'm not sure how to answer this in any more detail. It's once again one of those concepts that's very hard to explain without numbers.
Okay, that's fair enough, because it's hard to understand without the numbers as well. So
continuing on,
Representative Olson.
I think I'd like to correct one statement you made when you were comparing that this bill doesn't grab as much as ACES did. We didn't have a model, to the best of my knowledge, that went above $105 a barrel during the consideration of ACES. What ACES captured on the top end when we got up to $135 or $140 a barrel was certainly an unintended consequence. I don't believe that bill would have moved out of the legislature had we had models that went up to, say, $150 a barrel. The difference is you guys know what you're doing. At that point in time, that was a totally unintended consequence, at least to, I believe, most of us in the legislature.
The chair, Representative Olson, there's not a lot I can disagree with there. The legislature did not contemplate what would happen at $140 oil, especially at the cost profile that we had at that era, which was only $22-$25 a barrel in cost. There was a lot of taxable value for a few months, and with a monthly tax calculation, we had production tax rates with progressivity in excess of 50%. The point I was attempting to make a few minutes ago was when you're describing all of the upside or some of the upside or most of the upside, we're really talking about marginal tax rates at that point. You know, are we take, you know, if a company makes the incremental dollar, are we taking 80 cents of that, 20 cents of that, or somewhere in between? the change in vision by Section 17 here does take a little bit more of the incremental money that comes in if you have some high months versus some low months, but it does not approach the level of marginal tax of high percentages taken in high price spikes that ACES did. That's what the point I was trying to make. So, Section 18 of the bill relates to the carried forward annual loss credit as it applies to gross value reductions. Now, this is another technical piece, but it's very important, and I'm going to do all that I can to explain it with words before the committee. So, currently, the gross value reduction is a subtraction from taxable value before you calculate the tax. So, if it's and I'm going to use the colloquial terms legacy oil and new oil for the sake of simplicity here. With legacy oil, with oil that's not eligible for the gross value reduction, you get to your net profits, you get to your production tax value, and then you multiply it by the tax rate, 35%. These are North Slope only provisions, so 35%. If you have new oil, you get to your production tax value, you get to further adjust that production tax value through the subtraction of, for the most part, 20% of the gross value. You subtract 20% of the gross from the net, thus the term gross value reduction, come up with a reduced modified net profits, and then that number gets multiplied by the 35% tax rate. Effectively, it's a tax reduction, but there's technical reasons why the calculation was structured in that way, having to do with the commingling of expenses from field to field, which we don't need to go into right here. But the concept was to reduce the tax. What we learned was, what happens if instead of having a profit that might be reduced by this calculation so they paid a lower tax rate, what if the company in question has a loss? Well, if they have a loss under normal circumstances, legacy oil, they would be eligible for a net operating loss credit of a percentage of that loss. Last year, that was 45%. I made a similar statement when I was going through the bill the first time. A $10 million loss with a 45% operating loss credit would be a $4.5 million credit that we would pay out cash and make available to the company. What Section 18 of the bill does is to say, well, under current law, if that's new oil, if that's oil eligible for the GVR, that $10 million loss could be modified by a calculation based on the gross revenue and turned into a $30 million loss. The company actually lost $10 million. That's what their negative cash flow was. But if you allow the calculation, of the gross value reduction, that could look like a $30 million loss for purposes of tax. A 45% credit on a $30 million loss is $13.5 million in credit. And we would be in a position to write a $13.5 million credit check to offset a $10 million loss, giving them a credit of greater than 100% of the amount of the loss. So that was a circumstance that we found surprising that it was allowable under law, but it was, according to the attorneys, the strict interpretation of Senate Bill 21's provisions as they were written, and we have paid credits based upon that calculation. What Section 18 would do is say, it's not changing the gross value reduction in the circumstance where the company is paying taxes, but it is changing the gross value reduction if there is a loss, and says you can't use it to reduce the size of the operating loss for the purposes of calculating a credit. And it prevents that circumstance where we could potentially be paying credits of greater than 100% of the amount of the loss.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I hope when you bring in the graphic presentation, you'll have some way to explain that a little bit easier. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Herron.
Just so I try to understand, is this... I thought I heard you say this is a tax reduction, but isn't it actually a tax increase?
This provision would only be relevant in a circumstance where the taxpayer in question was in a loss. So it would be a reduction in the state's credit spend, a reduction in the credit offered to the company. And it would show up, if you're looking at the two sides of the ledger, the way the fiscal notes are constructed, as part of the negative spend, part of the reduction in the state's outlay.
But, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up, Representative Herron.
You I thought I heard you say that this is a tax reduction, but you just now explained that it is a tax increase, right?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Herron, I don't recall saying it was a tax reduction. You might have misheard me or I might have misspoken, but that was not my intent to say that this was a tax reduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So this is particularly applicable to new oil, is that correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, it is specifically and uniquely applicable to new oil in the North Slope.
And follow up, Mr. Chair. No. And so the problem we're trying to avoid is where we would pay more than the total expense of a project. The state could be contributing to, because it's all a net loss if they don't have production. And so the vagaries of the way the law is written, we could actually be providing the company more than 100% of their total costs, which generate the loss. Am I following that?
Through the Chair, Representative Seaton, not precisely, because it's not 100% of their costs. This provision is only relevant if the company in question has production. If they have some sort of sales, some sort of gross revenue, that they're producing oil, but in doing so, they're operating at a loss. That circumstance would occur in if A, very low prices, B, you sometimes see with a new field where they're producing from the early wells, but they're still building out the field, drilling subsequent wells, and they continue to operate at a loss for some years before the field is complete. If there is a loss, you have revenue minus expenses that leads to a negative number. The way the net operating loss credits work in that circumstance is the credit is tied to the net loss, the revenue minus expenses. And what we're trying to do is to say, to prevent the credit itself to be larger than the amount of the entirety of the loss.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to date, has that circumstance occurred?
Through the Chair, Representative Tarr, and it's hard because of confidentiality. I don't want to go into details, but there were a couple of specific credit applications since I've become director of the tax division that came to my attention that I actually questioned the calculation. I kicked it back to the auditor and said, this can't be right. But once we conferred with the audit masters, again, that's their role, to give the technical assistance for the complicated issues, and then checked with counsel, we found that the way the law was written, that was the appropriate treatment, that the auditor had it right, and we did owe that credit.
Representative Hawker.
And I'm first to agree with everybody here. You know, I'm struggling to get my arms around this, so, you know, I really want to see how it works. I'm still struggling with the fact that, again, the effective change here. The first part of this is just eliminating the pre-January or before January in 2014. But the operative language is that any reduction under AS 4355-160F or G is added back to the calculation of production tax values for the calendar year. And that is as you're referring to it, that was the gross value reduction as applicable to new oil. And am I wrong on that?
Through the Chair, Representative Hawker, I raised my finger. I'd just interrupt your question to clarify. This particular section is inside 4355-023B, which is the statutory section describing the carried forward annual loss credit.
Correct.
So it's only in the calculation of an annual loss credit. And when there's a circumstance which might trigger the annual loss credit, in other words, an annual loss, then you would be re-adding these gross value reductions before you calculated the credit itself.
I'm still not quite sure, Mr. Chair, because something I wanted you to a future debate or future dialogue here. You know, under 160F, we already had a provision in there that said that the GVR could not be used to reduce the gross value point of production below zero. and again, that was really, the whole mechanism there was adjusting our tax rate. We weren't going to allow essentially a tax rate adjustment. And I guess I'm not going to make sense out of my musing here, but I'm still trying to understand how both of those limitations apply to your judgment here. So again, I really am going to be looking forward to a far more clear explanation, because I'll be honest, I'm confused on this.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, and we're into technical provisions of law. There are places that say production tax value can't be less than zero, that so we're not paying taxes in reverse. But a net operating loss still exists even if production tax value is limited to zero. So the limits in 160F prevent the subtraction to get below a production tax value below zero, so we're not paying a negative tax, but the net operating loss is not impacted by that. What we're ensuring, I guess we're extending that limitation also to a net operating loss to say we can't use these reductions to increase the size of an operating loss. An operating loss itself is a cash flow calculation. It's tied to actual revenue and actual allowable expenditures. That's the basis for the operating loss credit right now.
Follow up?
The philosophy is all I can talk, but at this juncture on these details. But the point there exactly was that we are trying to, the big push from folks was to incent the development of new areas, again, new oil that wasn't otherwise going to be able to be brought forward. That's how we established the GVR. And in this case, because we really wanted to incent these new developments, these new producers, it, as you said, a very literal, very strict reading out of 21, you know, allows effectively when you're doing a carry forward net operating loss for an industry, a player, a new entrant, somebody that's bringing in new oil, someone who's developing new oil, to, if they are operating at a loss position, to truly get full value for those losses into the future. And here we're truncating that incentive that we were providing for the development of new oil. And I think that's why it was really different than further development in old oil. What is going to be our consequence? It's going to have a chilling effect on the pursuit of new oil, which was a very high priority for us, by essentially taking away that opportunity, that advantage, in a situation where somebody's getting started, they're getting their field developed, they're getting their initial production going, and they have a loss, and we're saying, oh, yeah, oh, by the way, that incentive that we gave, we're trying to give you to get this done, you don't get it when we look at so let's just call it a longer-term field life issue as opposed to a very small, short moment in time here. A point in time in an early part of a field development.
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, the actual negative cash flow that generates the operating loss is unchanged, and for the most part, we are not, in this section anyway, changing how it can be used. There's other sections of the bill that we'll get into that might modify how companies could use their operating loss credits. The way, philosophically, I would look at it is, the gross value reduction exists to reduce the tax burden on a new producer that's producing oil at a profit and therefore would owe taxes, and now they're going to owe less taxes. If that company is losing money for whatever reason, we have the net operating loss credit as a benefit to pay them back for a portion of their losses. What we found is circumstances where they're able to use both and magnify the size of their operating loss credit through using this new oil benefit. And it led to unexpected calculations. Philosophically, we can talk a long time, but I think we'll all benefit from having real numbers before the committee to show you examples.
Representative Josephson, thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Rappa, I look forward to hearing those examples. But my sense of this is we talked earlier about circumstances where, for example, in Middle Earth, there could be as much as an 80 cent on the dollar phenomenon, where the state is investing 80 cents for versus the taxpayers 20 cents on any investment. In this circumstance, when you combine in circumstances where you're on the North Slope, you have new oil, you benefit from a net operating loss credit and a second credit, and the totality of that is we're really exceeding the 80 cents. We're into the 120% of the total expense. We're paying for them to generate nothing, even though they produced something. So it's not like a new explorer credit where that was a phenomenon, is a phenomenon that happens. We're actually covering all their expenses, even in circumstances where they produce. Is that what you're saying happens here?
through the chair, Representative Josephson, in part, it's the same answer I gave to Representative Seaton's question a few minutes ago. It's not necessarily all of their expenses, but it's all of their loss. We are compensating for more than 100% of their cash flow loss, and that's what we're hoping to fix through this provision.
Mm-hmm. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just looking back, you know, it seems to me what happened, ACES, we didn't model high enough. SB 21, we didn't model low enough. Because I don't recall us actually contemplating, you know, for the large companies, situations where they would have net operating loss, because that's an unusual circumstance that we find ourselves in because of the very low prices. Would that be an accurate statement, or can you elaborate on that thinking a little bit, and how, when you do provide numbers to us, that we pick the range of realities that we might actually experience rather than, you know, truncate on either end? That has, I think all of us could agree, gotten us into some trouble when unexpected things happen.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, there's a psychological bias to assume the present's going to continue on into the future, and that extends to both regular people and academic economists and everyone in between. There's always the broad discussion of what could happen, but within the modeling and the day-to-day specifics brought before the committees during the hearings of these bills, I said it earlier, and not everyone agreed. My sense, having sat as a staffer in this building through both of those bills, the ACES bill tended to look at a range of prices in the 40 to 80 range, and as Representative Olson said a little bit ago, didn't really contemplate what happened if we got a price spike. Senate Bill 21 tended to focus its conversation on a range of prices between 80 and 120 and not fully contemplate and model what might have occurred at severely lower prices. Not to say that people were ignorant of it, but that it wasn't a prominent part of the conversation.
Mr. Chairman.
A follow-up?
Can we avoid that as we move forward, and just and an honest request to look at a broad range of prices and how some of these changes impact things, just to have a better and deeper understanding?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, it is my sincere hope to go as broad as possible. I think that's a great idea, and not to be flippant, sometimes we're limited by the width of the piece of paper and how many columns we could fit on it. But we used to model general fund revenue estimates for the year based upon a certain set of assumptions. We published one last year that went between $40 and $140. We did this. We updated the report for this year, and now it goes down to $20. You know, sometimes the font just has to get small.
Thank you.
So we're just about to the end of our meeting, Mr. Director Alper. Have you got anything to wrap up with, or are you in a good spot?
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're done with a specific section, there's no spot in a section analysis is any better than any others. We are about halfway through the bill, so if you'd like to have, we will be back before the committee in a week or so with the next tier of information and for the quantitative analysis. But if you'd like to bring us back next week, if you have the time to finish the sectional analysis, or tomorrow or whenever is appropriate, I'm more than happy to finish up this conversation.
Okay, thank you. And I'd just like the committee know that both the director and the commissioner we've discussed, and they are going to compile some more information for us with quite a few more details. Let you know that Monday and Wednesday and Friday we are scheduled to deal with House Bill 253, which is the mining tax, and I will work directly with these two gentlemen to see timing-wise, scheduling-wise. I certainly want to give you enough time to compile those things that we had talked about earlier today. I will stay in touch with you on that for sure. And if there's no more business before the committee, we will adjourn at 3 p.m.